Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. With more than 30 weekly podcasts, HRN has something for every food lover. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Hello, hello, Heritage Radio Network listeners tuning in from 165 countries around the world, about a million listens a month. And I know everybody is waiting for this week's episode of Tech Bites, the weekly show where we look at the intersection of food and technology. And today that intersection is mushrooms. Today is the first of two shows we're doing on mushrooms. This is episode 286. Next week, we will do episode 287. Have you noticed a lot of mushrooms in the news, in the media, in your social media, in your Instagram, TikTok, Facebook? I've seen a lot of mushrooms and a lot of things about mushrooms, all kinds of mushrooms. On one end of the spectrum, we have the magic mushrooms and the psilocybin mushrooms that are trippy and maybe hallucinogenic, that are things that people use in maybe spiritual or party or, you know, that type of environment. But I've also been seeing a lot of articles recently about the medical profession, medical mental health profession, talking about psilocybins and mushrooms to be used for therapy for different types of things successfully, which is interesting and maybe something that we might see legalized and on offer in the future. I've also seen a lot of things about mushrooms. There are just so many different types of mushrooms, but adaptogens, mushroom tea, chocolate, tonic, powders, things to add to your smoothie, cereal that will make you feel great, energized, relaxed, sleepy, better memory, all kinds of things. I mean, they're not magic mushrooms, but all of those things sound kind of magical. And then we have mushrooms just as the ingredient, you know, the basic mushroom that you would buy, but mushrooms are also being used as the foundation for other ingredients. They're everywhere. So I thought, you know what, now would be a good time to maybe do a show or two about mushrooms and what's happening in the mushroom category. We're not going to be talking about psilocybins and magic mushrooms. Next week, we'll be talking about mushrooms in a more coffee, chocolate, additive, energy, coffee substitute, mushroom chocolates to help you go to sleep at night capacity. So that will be a fun show. Today, we are talking about mushrooms creating plant-based steaks and cutlets that's kind of are like chicken or meat. The company's called Meati, M-E-A-T-I, Meati.com. And today we're talking with Tyler Huggins, who is the CEO and co-founder of Meati. We've talked a lot about plant-based alternatives to animal and meat products on this show over time. And they're made in a lot of different ways. Oftentimes they are made in a lab grown, sometimes using cells. Sometimes it's a very complicated, complex, long industrial food production chain using a lot of different ingredients that are not really things you could pick up in a grocery store or a farmer's market. Everybody's sort of racing to figure out a way to get away from animal farming, animal products, something that's better for the environment, something that's perhaps better for people, to solve our ever urgent problems of the environment and feeding a growing population. So Meati definitely dips into that core category, but there are a couple of really interesting components about it, which make it an interesting conversation for this show on so many fronts. So without further ado, Tyler, thank you for joining us.
Hello. Yeah, thanks for inviting me.
So we'll unroll this the way we unroll most things, sort of in a nice chronological order. The way founders come to their companies and creating their products and come to their missions is always very interesting. I should probably do a book about that at some point. I think about that all the time. I should do a Tech Bytes book about founders and innovation and all that kind of stuff. And maybe I will. I mean, I have 286 episodes of almost all of them talking to founders. But Tyler, you have a very logical progression now that we look back at it. Perhaps it didn't seem so at the time. You are a field scientist. You spend time out in the world, in the forest, in the fields with the plants, and are very closely aligned to studying that and following that and figuring out what happens with that. That's your sort of starting point, yes?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I was born and raised in rural Montana. So, you know, just even growing up, we spent a lot of time out in the woods, you know, whether hunting or fishing or camping. And so it was a sort of a natural progression for me to go work for the Forest Service. So I was a field biologist and wilderness ranger for about 6 years, studying both forest health and rangeland ecology.
What does that actually mean? I mean, it sounds interesting and very official, but what did you actually do and study? And then what was the results of your study?
You know, when I first started off, again, it was more forest health work. So it was both studying the you know, different you know, parts of national forests and cataloging and mapping the diversity and the health of different forests. And then we would apply different strategies in order to improve the health, mostly around fire mitigation work. So we would have a crew, usually firefighters, before fire season, and we would go into the woods and we would thin it out. We'd go to areas that were prone or had a lot of you know, beetle kill or other, you know, pest kills that was super dense and had, you know, for a long time we've been suppressing fires, and so you had, you know, almost overpopulation of trees that were ended up being unhealthy and that would result in catastrophic fires. So we did that for a long time. And then I started transitioning into rangeland ecology. So that's basically, you know, grasslands, areas that are used for cattle production. And we would study the health of it. You know, how healthy was the grass? What was the biodiversity? Was there noxious weeds? And then what sort of methodologies can we use in order to improve it so that it had more biodiversity, it had better grass, it was a healthier ecosystems.
So I'm going to make note that you are talking about and studying a ecosystem and a natural environment that has a lot of different components that are existing together, animals, plants, and all kinds of things, and that they need to sort of exist together and all be healthy and interact in the right balance for life to be successful there.
That, and I think the other, you know, I think that the seed that was planted early for me was the interactions. You had sort of nature in its own unadulterated form doing its thing. And then there's the human interaction and how we work the land, how we extract resources, how jobs are created from working with the lands and that interaction. And, you know, over the years, I wanted to develop, you know, different approaches to be able to have that relationship be more symbiotic instead of just strictly extractive, where the land was degraded over time, into a way we could interact. We could still have the resource extraction that we need. We still have jobs, but it actually is beneficial for the land. And it was a more symbiotic relationship. And that's really sort of the second phase of my career was, you know, searching that path and trying to develop solutions and technologies and ultimately a business that could, again, have that ultimate result.
It's interesting that you talk about wanting to have a ecosystem and a landscape that is not simply extractive, which essentially just means people coming and taking what they want out of it without really thinking about what the results are or if they're going to be able to continue to do that. You know, this really makes me think about an episode that we did back in 2021, episode 245, about the Forge Project, which is a fellowship program for Indigenous Americans. And one of the women who was the first, one of the first fellows in their first cohort, was working on a field guide to restore, you know, knowledge about plants and food systems. And it was really very interesting. And she said something that really resonated with me because I still do remember it. She talked about when people, from other countries, immigrants, you know, long time ago, mostly the Europeans came and they came to the Americas, specifically North America, and they found, you know, the forests and the fields and the land just being so abundant and really beautiful and that sort of, you know, Garden of Eden type of idea. She was very pointed in saying that it wasn't like that just because nature made it so. She said there had been people living on the land really with a point of view of stewardship, sort of cultivating and making sure that everything flourished, but in balance. And so when people showed up and they're like, oh my God, this is amazing. Look at what nature made. It's like, yes, but no, there's like thought and effort that went into it to create a balanced and bountiful ecosystem like that.
I love that you bring that up. I mean, that's exactly sort of, you know, that was a realization for me as well. Is this idea that, you know, there's nature and then there's humans and that they all live separately from each other, or they always have. You know, that those days are long gone. You know, we are now, you know, we have humans have influenced the natural world and the landscapes around us for, you know, thousands of years and have shaped it, to your point. And a lot of, especially in North America, you know, it was a symbiotic relationship. It was an active gardening, if you will. And I think we need to bring back that philosophy and that approach where it's not just letting nature be, we have to separate ourselves, but actually interact in a way that is mutually beneficial.
So you are working professionally, looking at the ecosystems, how they can best be managed from a lot of different points of view. And then how do you make the leap from that to creating essentially, you know, giant mushroom chicken tenders?
I mean, definitely a long and windy road. But I was doing, you know, I started my first company, Restoring the Rockies, and where we were a private company doing land restoration work. So I hired a bunch of ex-firefighters. We would go into the woods, we'd clean it up, we'd make it healthier. We went out into, you know, Nebraska and other areas and cleaned up grasslands and made them better. Ultimately, that was just, it wasn't at the scale in which I wanted to create a positive impact on the world. It wasn't sort of big enough. And so I decided, you know, I wanted to develop this thesis about, you know, all these lessons that I learned studying natural systems, studying, you know, different organisms, their niches in the environment. And really developed this viewpoint that, you know, nature was kind of a toolbox and that each sort of species, whether it's plants or animals or bacteria, had developed certain attributes to make it successful in a very sort of competitive symbiotic world. And I wanted to go back to graduate school and learn how to guide that process or, you know, various processes in order to, again, create this a more, you know, harmonious relationship with nature. So I went back to graduate school. I got my PhD in environmental engineering. So again, using, you know, mostly microbes to clean water, to produce materials, you know, just kind of going down that route. And then ultimately I started working with mycelium, which is not the mushroom cap itself, but it's actually this thread-like structure that's in the soil, kind of looks like roots. And I had studied this when I was as a Forest Service biologist and the relationship with plants. And I thought, you know, if you could control that, if you could guide that natural process, you could produce all kinds of materials and you could really benefit the world. So I started working on, you know, that at a fundamental level. How do you control the growth? How do you make different structures and different morphologies, different chemical composition and grow it and cultivate it and guide it along its path? It's what it naturally wants to do. Ultimately, I found, you know, I really wanted to, you know, the goal was, you know, positive change in the world. And I was sort of agnostic on how I was going to do this. Ultimately, I found that, you know, food is a great place to not only benefit the world, the natural world, the environment, but also people. And given, you know, my parents, something I didn't mention, my parents run a grass-fed bison operation. And I'd always, you know, spent a lot of time in agriculture and animal husbandry. And so that was always, you know, part of my life and upbringing. And so then it was a natural sort of progression of, you know, how do we create, you know, solutions that will create positive change? And food was ultimately the path that I went down. And, you know, I would argue we produce a delicious new type of meat using, again, not the mushroom cap itself, but actually the root structure.
So many things there. And you jumped the gun on the family farm. We were going to totally get to that later. But yeah, I mean, it's fascinating, which is... it's atypical for founders in the plant-based meat alternative space, is what I'll say. But we will get to that. Let's back up first and start with the mushroom mycelium. When you say it's the root and not the cap, when I visualize a mushroom, I picture the little round cap and then a foot, and then it would grow in the ground. So is the mycelium the foot or the stem of the mushroom, or is the mycelium actually the part that's growing underground?
So it's the part that grows underground. It's in, you know, miles of it in every square inch of soil. And actually all mushrooms, so mushrooms are, and I'm sure the mycologists that are listening to me are going to cringe, but mushrooms are essentially the fruit. You can think of them as the fruit of a fungi. So the mycelium is growing underground. Then when it wants to reproduce, it produces a mushroom cap. And then that releases spores and starts the cycle. So actually mushrooms themselves are made of mycelium. It's the mycelium that comes up above ground and creates this vegetative fruiting body that then produces spores. Now we just grow the mushroom root itself.
So you don't have any of the caps and the spores. I saw a fascinating video on Instagram of a mushroom releasing spores, and it was in some sort of hyper-focused time-lapse photography, and it literally looked like things launching off the cap of the mushroom, like a spray of, it almost looked like birds or sand or something like that. It was really fascinating.
It's a really cool process. And I think, you know, especially as humans, we only really, you know, appreciate, or we seem to appreciate more the things that we can see, the things that we can touch and feel. But actually in the soil is a whole magical world of activity that we just, you know, even now we don't fully understand and can, you know, result in such amazing things like that you just discussed.
So did you select mushroom mycelium then because it just propagates so easily, it's very abundant? You know, when we were talking earlier about mushrooms and the, you know, nutritional components and how easily it can be cultivated, it really made me think of the seaweed trend that we saw a few years ago, which we're still experiencing today because all those products are still here. There's a big interest in seaweed products and seaweed cultivation and seaweed farms because it is so easy to farm. It's so bountiful and has a pretty decent nutrient density. So did you pick mushrooms because of that? Was there another reason? Does it just happen to be in your neck of the woods, literally? And you're like, oh, this is great. This happens to be right here in my backyard. So let's work with that.
A little bit of both. You know, I think, you know, when we were looking at, okay, if you want to create positive change in food, meat is a great place to start. Obviously, it's part of our culture and a main component of, you know, millions, billions of people's diets. But it also has a high environmental footprint. So it's a great place if you want to create a positive change. But if you're going to compete in meat, it's got to be meat-like. It has to have that texture, the fibrousness, the juiciness, the pull, the mouthfeel of meat, of muscle structure. So that is really important. It also has to be packed full of protein. That is, you know, a major reason why we eat meat, high in protein, and vitamin Bs and zinc and iron and a few other things. So it's got to have this nutritional content that we associate with meat. Obviously, it has to taste delicious. It has to taste like animal-based meat. And then if you want to create a solution that is superior to what we currently have, yes, it needs to be able to be produced more efficiently with less resources, less overall impact. And so that was sort of the guardrails. Now, if you look out into nature and you say, okay, well, what has those attributes? You know, right now, as you mentioned in the intro, a lot of people are trying to use plants. The challenge with plants is plants aren't really that good at producing protein. They're really good at producing starch. So that's the, you know, one of the challenges. You have to grow a lot of plants in order to just get a small amount of protein out of it. And you have to extract that protein and concentrate it in order to get to the levels in which we would see in meat. And that requires all kinds of problems because you don't have the texture. It has off flavors. Again, some of the things that we're seeing right now with the current plant-based offerings. What's really cool about mycelium, our particular type of mycelium, is that it's 60% by weight protein, very high in protein. So you don't have to extract it. You can actually eat the mushroom root, the mycelium itself, which is pretty unique. It's a complete protein. It has all the essential amino acids. It has all your iron, your vitamin Bs, your zinc, again, nutrients that we associate with meat. And then given this fibrous texture, this long range fibers, it mimics muscle structure. It has a very similar mouthfeel and cooking experience as you would find with meat. And then ultimately, to your point, it grows really fast. I mean, I love the seaweed work that's going on because seaweed is one of the fastest growing organisms on the planet. And actually our type of mycelium is up there, is like the second fastest growing. So extremely fast, very efficient. You know, you just basically feed it sugar. It eats all the sugar and grows. So in its total package, you know, not only is it one of the most nutritious meats in the world, it is by far the most efficient way to produce meat out there.
So the interesting thing is that you are a founder of a plant-based alternative for an animal product. And your goal is a more harmonious environment between people and plants so that everything can be sustained and balanced, it sounds like. Where I always ask my founders who are focused on plant-based and the environment, how do you project or view people eating meat into the future? Are you creating this product because you don't want people eating meat or using any animal products in the future? Is this a two-pronged approach, one to save the environment, but the other to sort of create a vegan environment, society going forward?
I believe in diversity in our diets. I think more options, more healthy, sustainably produced options, the better. And so I don't think this is there's a silver bullet. I don't think there's one strict diet in which we have to adopt. And so, you know, I'm not a vegan or vegetarian, but I do value high quality meat. And that's the world in which I'm trying to promote, in which we take the pressures off of commodity-based meat production, industrial meat production. You know, I don't think it's an evil conspiracy that these, you know, the individuals in this industry want to hurt the land and want to torture animals. It's a pressure to lower the price to as low as they possibly can because it's a commodity. That results in poor practices, poor land management, you know, mistreatment of animals. All those things are bad and something that I want to improve on. So if we can provide more options, especially ones that are at scale, massive scale, that are affordable, obviously are delicious and well accepted by people, then we can diversify our meat system. We can take that pressure off. And then what I would love to see is it go back to using practices that I know farmers and ranchers know how to do. That's better for the land, that's better for animals. Yes, it's going to be more expensive. Animal meat will be more expensive, but we just eat less of it. We eat it when it's a celebration. We have it on the weekends or whenever, but you're going to pay a little bit more for it. And then your daily sort of, you know, go-to protein and meat source can be like products like Meaty or others to help diversify the system.
Diversity. That's a nice word. We like that. We like diversity. So many times people have a very uninclusive, undiverse point of view. And, you know, diversity seems to be an important component for success for a group of people living on a planet that are so diverse as ours. Having an idea, regardless of what that idea is, whether it's, you know, farm, meat, plant substitute, animal-based, lab-grown, you know, trying to propagate one point of view and one solution never seems to be very successful.
Agreed.
We're going to take a quick pause and find out who is underwriting this show. Did you know Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit, and we keep the lights on and the mics hot out of the generosity of underwriters like this one? Stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's, the pizza restaurant, is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City and now in Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
You are listening to Tech Bites, the weekly show on the Heritage Radio Network, where we look at the intersection of food and technology. And today, that intersection is mushrooms. We're doing a two-part show on mushrooms. It's a trend. It's functional food. It's new food. It's adaptogens and making you energized and relaxed. So many things. Today, we are talking with Tyler Huggins, who is the CEO and co-founder of a company called Meati. Meati.com. You can find them on social media at Meati Foods across most platforms. Their current product offering is a meat steak cutlet. One is sort of natural. One is breaded like a chicken cutlet. They're very chickeny in the sort of feel and taste and texture and look. They are made from mushrooms and, interestingly, just other basic ingredients like salt, paprika, fruit juice, oat fiber, olive oil, salt, sugar. Really basic ingredients, ingredients that we recognize as ingredients, ingredients that we could go and buy in the grocery store or online. So many of the plant-based, lab-grown, alternative things are highly processed and have ingredients that we don't know what they are and have created an entire separate industry of creating these plant-based products to recreate mouthfeel, sensations, and all of that, which is just really fascinating. I guess people want what they want, and if people want to eat meat and you don't want them to, you have to give them something that tastes and feels and seems like meat. Even if maybe producing that meat might not be the same environmental impact as raising, say, a cow, but it does have impact and it does have waste and it does take energy in a lab and an assembly line to produce all these things. So we're at an interesting time, I think, where consumers need to be very educated about what they're eating. Plant-based doesn't always mean good for you, for your body, for the planet. It doesn't always mean it's nutritious. It doesn't always mean that it's produced efficiently and effectively and doesn't have its own chain of waste and energy. So I think we're at a time right now with all of these new plant-based products, lab-grown products, animal plant substitutes, where we were maybe 10 or 15 years ago with organic. What does organic mean? What does free range mean? What does all of that? Consumers needed to educate themselves. What's happening in the coffee market? that's something that we went through also 10, 15 years ago. Coffee was just coffee. Same thing with chocolate. Chocolate was just chocolate. But now we have a better understanding of how it's produced in different parts of the country. We have a better idea of what all of those variety of beans are, how they're produced. Maybe some are produced better. Some are produced with people being paid a fair wage in a manner that is beneficial to the environment. Some are not. Some are made with child labor in ways that strip the land. Same thing with plant farms. Same thing with vegetable farms. Just because it's a vegetable farm doesn't mean it's good for the environment. Just because it's an animal farm doesn't mean it's bad for the environment. And I think to Tyler's point, part of probably what gives him his perspective is that his family has a bison ranch, which is amazing. We've talked about regenerative farming and sort of holistic farming on this show. If it's something that you're interested in, I would go back in the Tech Bytes archives to episode 2019, which was about regenerative farming, a farm on the East Coast. I would go back to episode 245, the Forge Project, which is a fellowship program for Indigenous Americans. And one talks about sort of the history and the different practices and plants in nature. The last one that we did was episode 264, Silvopasture Tech Stack, which is essentially using nature to create a tech stack to do what you need to do at a farm. So it's very interesting, symbiotic, everything feeding into the ecosystem together, not the extremity of one or the other. I mean, that sounds like a good idea to me. Sounds like something that's rational and reasonable. And then Tyler, but you believe that within the system of having animal farms and animal products, you need to have these other alternatives.
I do. I think given the amount of people that we need to feed today and into the future, we've got to develop multiple different solutions. We have to increase our output and our agricultural practices. We've got to increase the health of the food that we eat. And then we need to reduce the overall impact that we have. And so I think, you know, to do that, you have to build multiple different solutions. We've got to diversify our food system. We've got to try and adopting, you know, new practices.
What made you, did the idea of doing sort of chicken-like steaks and cutlets, did that come first as the idea or did that come second after you decided you wanted to work with mycelium and mushrooms?
I think it was a little bit of both. You know, I had been working with mycelium in the past and then identifying, again, looking at food as a place to have, you know, massive global positive impact. The idea with going out with a chicken-like or beef-like products is one we debated for a long time. But we thought it was important to create products that people were already familiar with. You know, if you're going to introduce something new, I think you can only, it's a little more difficult if it's all completely new and totally outside the box. We wanted to give our consumers something that they're familiar with. They know how to cook chicken. They know what the eating experience is like. They have, you know, recipes that they follow. But we didn't want it to be exactly. And I think that's ultimately where we'll go with this, is you have a new type of meat that is just delicious, but it has that same, you know, again, the nutritional profile. If not, it's actually even better than traditional meat. It has fiber and other vitamins and minerals you only find in plants. But it's still the same cooking and eating experience. And then ultimately, we can just make it taste delicious. Different flavors. It's really sort of endless in what we can do with this.
It's always interesting to me when I talk with founders of, you know, plant-based or lab-grown products that want to become the new version of what has been to date animal-based. Many times they say that, you know, I ask if they want, you know, the animal product, the dairy product, the meat product to become something in the future that no one has had. That's something that just exists, you know, in movies or in books, that we reach a generation of people who have never had dairy ice cream or an actual beef burger. And many times they say yes, that is part of their goal, not just to save the planet, but also just to eradicate animal-based products. And it's an interesting idea to me in that people are so driven by creating a substitute for something for that transitional piece, for that crossing the chasm piece, which is famously an innovation idea, to get people from point A to point B, because theoretically, if it's a new product and a new item made with new ingredients, could it just be something new? You know? Like, why does it have to be something that kind of is pretending to be something else? Couldn't it just be some new thing of, like, we made this new thing, it's delicious, you should eat it.
And that's our goal, really is. I think we're trying to give you something that you're familiar with, so you kind of know what you're going to expect. You're like, okay, that's probably like chicken. That way it kind of reduces the barrier to consumption. And especially our goal is to be a product for everyone. We want this to be in every grocery store. We want this to be accessible to everyone. And so what we know is that a lot of people like chicken, a lot of people like beef. And so that's a good place to start, to get people to try it, to become familiar with mushrooms and mycelium and how this can be made and how cool and special it is, how it can be good for you and benefit your life and the planet. And then as we get more awareness, then to your point, I think we'll create something new, and it'll just be meaty, a new type of meat.
Or not necessarily with a touch point of something else. Just be like, here's the thing. Just like eating a new thing at a restaurant or in a country or in a place you've never been. It's like, oh, here, this is a new thing that you've never had. It's good.
It'll be the meaty tacos.
It's not going to be a reference to anything else. Mm-hmm. It's really, all those things are so interesting to me. So you started Meaty in 2017. This is 2023. Yep. How's it going?
It's been a wild ride for sure. You know, our challenge, we knew right away we had something special. We got in front of, chefs and seasoned food veterans, and they said, yes, this is it. This is what the market's been looking for. We know consumers want alternatives. They want diversity in their diet. They want solutions that are not only healthy for them, but for the planet. That's not really that controversial. But they're not going to compromise on flavor and the eating experience. And it needs to be healthy. It needs to be real whole food. And you guys have been able to do that. The challenge for us was scaling and supply. I mean, this category is enormous. You know, the volumes in the meat category are in the billions. It's hard to even wrap your head around. And so in order to compete, in order to actually make the impact we want, we not only have to drive demand, but supply. We're fully vertically integrated. We grow the mycelium, the mushroom root in-house in our own system, make sure it's clean and healthy and efficient. And we produce the finished good and package it as well. There was no infrastructure. There was no farmers or ranchers of mushroom root. We had to start this whole category and this whole industry. And that requires money. Venture dollars and building out the infrastructure. So that's what we've been doing for, ever since we started, was building out these facilities in order to have the supply to get it out to people. And right now is a big moment for the company. We just finished what we call our mega ranch. It'll produce tens of millions of pounds of product, state of the art, really cool, one of a kind facility where we grow the mushroom root. And we just launched in all Sprouts locations yesterday.
That's amazing. Congratulations.
Thank you.
On your big ranch, which is not actually a ranch, it looks like a factory. People aren't going to pull up and see like green trees and stuff. Are you conscientious of the energy output and your carbon footprint and all those things? Because that's something that people don't necessarily consider. They think about the ingredient. They think about the product, the end product. Is it good for me? Is it good for my family? I mean, part of the issue about some of the industrial farming, whether it be plant or animal, some of the primary issues that we have in, looking at this industry are not just about the quality of the final product, but what's happening along the production chain. And oftentimes, as you articulated earlier, there's bad things happening.
Absolutely. And I really appreciate you bringing up earlier this fact that, like, just because it's a plant doesn't mean that it was grown in a way that was, you know, beneficial to nature.
I mean, famously Monsanto corn and soybeans, from the movie and everything.
Bananas, there are a lot of crops that are just devastating to the land, can be very, chemical intensive, resource intensive, hard on the workers. So you really have to look holistically at end to end, the full life cycle approach to how we produce our food to really understand, what is the full impact. And that's what we did from the very beginning. We not only did we have to create something, again, that was delicious and that people would love and it was nutritious, we knew it had to be built on a platform that was ultimately less impactful and the most efficient way to produce meat. We set those guardrails and we started designing it accordingly. We'll be producing LCA, so full life cycle assessment numbers. We test and we study and we collect data from end to end and understanding the impact that we have from our current production method. And, so far the numbers that are coming in are just a fraction of what it currently takes to produce meat in this country. And we're just getting started. Are we perfect? Not by any means. I'm not going to say that we're 100% perfect. We just got started, but we've identified areas in which we can continue to improve. You know, where we get our sugar from, we are at the whim of industrial agriculture. We can't dictate how the sugar is produced, but we can try to source it as best as we can. Ultimately, in the future, we'd love to influence that category. And then, of course, how we produce it, electrifying everything, using renewable energy. We do have line of sight based on their approach. This can be totally closed loop. It could be zero water discharge. I mean, really excited the potential of what we can do here. It's just a matter of time and money to get us to the place we want to be. But even right now, we're still, just again, a fraction of what's required currently.
And we really only have a fraction of time that would be required to keep talking about production and all those types of things. I always tell my guests we will run out of time, and we essentially have, which is a good thing because we have more episodes and more shows. I'm going to ask you just really quickly, though, just to sort of close the conversation on the production, because for any new business, anything in the food tech space, scaling is the big hurdle. You have a great idea. You can beta test it. You can make a few. You can send them to, sell them to a small market. But scale, especially in something like, chicken and chicken breasts and commodities, and especially when we talk about feeding a planet of billions and billions of people, the technology, the idea of what you're doing, the technology that you're working with, how much of it is new things that you have to create? How much of it is repurposing something that's on the shelf? You are very specifically creating essentially a giant chicken cutlet from mushrooms, which was good. I won't lie. Meaty sent me a box of the different products that they have, and we had them for dinner the other night, and it was pretty good. I mean, it like got crispy and it was nicely flavored and it did have a good texture, and it did have that like lightly mushroomy texture to it, which was not unpleasant. And also maybe because I knew I was focused on the idea of mushroom, but it was quite good. I had one for dinner with some sauteed vegetables and it was great. Are you talking with other founders and companies that are trying to create these renewable energy farm production lines that are new? Maybe he's trying to solve new problems, new technology. I mean, it must be challenging to do anyway on your own. Do you have the time and the bandwidth to collaborate with other companies?
Mm-hmm. So when we started down this path, we also knew that we couldn't completely reinvent the wheel. We needed to look out into industry, food production, and try to pick processes that were already at scale, that already worked, in order to take the risk off the table. So we could show investors, hey, this may be new in its totality, but each individual process has been done somewhere in food production, whether it's, producing citric acid during the fermentation process to bread and cheese making downstream. And we're able to to put this together in a very unique way. So we're using off-the-shelf equipment and doing novel things with it in order to do what we do today. Very scalable. It's just a matter of time and money in order to build out the infrastructure. And, you know, again, our mission is to have global positive change. We're not going to be able to do this alone. We're going to have to partner with people who can help us go faster. This is not a demand problem. There is so much demand out there for good, high quality meat. The problem is a supply problem. And so how can we build this out? I mean, it took, you know, a couple hundred years to build out our current infrastructure just in the United States. How can we do that in just a fraction of the time? That's going to require a lot of investment and a lot of partnerships.
Interesting. Very interesting. So often we focus on what's on the plate because that is the thing closest to our personal and individual survival, eating in the moment for day-to-day survival. But the larger process, you know, as we become more aware and give consideration to carbon footprint and production facilities and all those types of things, it's a lot. It can be overwhelming sometimes, I think, to consumers. It's probably overwhelming to you as a founder trying to solve these issues rapidly in a way that's highly productive. You know, I note another show that we did, which was very interesting, was about App Harvest, which is the Appalachian-based company that is indoor tomato farming, essentially, you know, hydroponic tomato farming, because tomatoes are the second most purchased produce, I think, in the country. They're billions and billions of dollars. And something like 90% of the American tomato market, supermarket tomatoes, come from Mexico. So the company is looking at taking a chunk out of that, but also very thoughtfully built the facility, which is huge, in Appalachia as an idea to replace employment opportunities that were lost when coal started to close, coal mining, and that fossil fuel business started to close. So it's also an interesting idea of new things, new people, you know, kind of switching out, which happens all the time. One industry replaces another industry. One closes and, you know, another one springs up. So much to consider, though. It's got to be overwhelming. How do you move forward day to day when you must have a to-do list of, like, you know, 1.3 million things?
At least, you know, just one step at a time. Obviously, it's the only choice we have. You know, we're taking some really big swings. You know, we took a leap of faith that we had a product that people wanted, and we started building out the required infrastructure to do so. It's just, again, at this scale and the need, we need to take some big, bold bets. I love what the folks are doing with urban farming and renewable ag. And I think it's all of these combinations together. There's no one silver bullet, but we've all got to just keep trying to make it better.
Well, keep trying, make it better, talk to more people, make more radio. I want to thank Tyler Huggins, CEO and co-founder of Meaty, for talking with us today about his mushroom cutlet business. If you're interested in finding out more about that, go to meaty.com, M-E-A-T-I.com. Find them on social media at Meaty Foods. If you want to get some for yourself, you can order on the website. You can also go to Sprouts Farmers Market. If you want to see Tyler, he'll be at South by Southwest talking on some panels. If you are interested in mushrooms as a food tech trend, come back and listen next week. We'll be doing another show, this time about chocolates and teas and tonics. If you love Tech Bites and the idea of all these founders and CEOs trying to create more delicious, equitable food products that are good for the planet and for people, come back and listen. Subscribe on your favorite platform, on your favorite podcasting platform. Leave us a 5-star review. That'll help more people discover the show. If you think it's really important to have a platform like this to pass the mic to founders like Tyler to put a spotlight on things that are happening in the world, go to heritageradionetwork.org, click the beating heart, and make a donation or become a member. You know, you could send us what you spend on a cup of coffee today, and it'll help us make more radio. I'm Jennifer Liuzzi, and this is Tech Bites.
This show is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.